sleep. I feel like I'm being prepared for surgery here. Maybe I am. It is really wonderful to be back. It is nice to look out and see so many familiar faces. I'm thinking about the first time I came here, kind of in fear and trepidation. This was my first experience with a Catholic group, and I had no idea if you were going to chew me up and have me for dinner, and one or two of you really tried, but we all survived it, and what I discovered was the most wonderful bunch of people, and I've missed you a lot. It's been over a year since I've met with you, and I don't know. Yeah, I come here and I get this shot of energy that lasts me for months and months. And so I'm really glad to be here. My exile happened because my oldest daughter and her family were in some financial difficulties, and they were here in Santa Barbara and could not afford housing. And I was going away for the summer, and so I said, well, why don't you stay in my house for the summer while you decide what you're going to do, and then I'll come back and everything will be fine. Well, I came back almost 2 years later because that just kept extending it and extending itself. During that time, I had an experience of not having a home. And I was completely reliant on family and friends to put me up. And spent a lot of time trying not to outstay my welcome anywhere. And I always could tell when I was starting to outstay my welcome. It wasn't hard to figure out. And in one way, it gave me a sense of solidarity with the homeless, because it is very strange not to have a home of your own. And I had not experienced that as an adult person. And so that led me to a lot of thinking. But as I was reading Crosby's book, I was aware of the unbelievable arrogance of even thinking about calling myself homeless. I was not homeless. Mm-hmm. I always had a place to lay my head. And it got me thinking about these myriads of people that do not have a place to lay their heads, do not have family or friends that will take them in, cannot find institutions that will care for them in humane ways. And the whole impact of this book, where he talks so relentlessly about justice issues and realizing that we in this country, we don't begin to understand what those are. We have not experienced what it's like to be on the other end of that. We may have visited countries, we may have even gone and worked with the poor, but we always had a place to put our heads. And we had homes to come back to, and we had bank accounts and security nets and everything else. And so this was just really jumped out at me as I was reading the book. We have, one of the things that this study calls us to do is to step out of our comfortable security and place of power and look at the state of the world. And look at how much we personally are responsible for that state of the world. I love his referring back to Walmart all the time. I just really like that. I love Walmart. I go there all the time. It's cheap, right? But it is responsible for poverty and oppression and economic chaos. And one of these days, we have got face up to this, and this is one of the great giftedness of this book. He is relentless about this. We have got to move out of our little, oh yeah, we understand the poor thing. We don't understand the poor. Jim Wallace came to speak to Centerpoint several years ago, and he told a story about that period when Bush had been elected to the presidency, but it was still contested. And Bush had called a number of clergy people together. And for those of you that don't know who Jim Wallace is, he's an evangelical liberal. He's a fascinating person, responsible for the Sojourners movement, prolific writer, very hard on American culture in general, and those of us that are comfortable in particular, and rightfully so. But Bush asked Wallace to take a walk with him. And while they were walking, he said, "Jim, I need you to explain the poor to me. I don't understand the poor." Now, that story stayed with me because I think that's really true, and I think that was a very honest statement on Bush's part. I really don't think he understands the poor, and I think much of what he does illustrates that. But I don't think Bush is alone in this. Bush is our representative, and I think we're all the same way. I don't think we understand the poor. And this study on the Beatitudes and the Beatitudes themselves are calling us to task for this. And if for no other reason, this is an incredibly important book. The last little thing I want to just say about myself a little bit is, most of you will know, but perhaps not all of you, that my denomination, the United Church of Christ, is about as liberal as you can get. We pride ourselves on being out there in the cutting edge, and we're always in trouble because we're doing things before anybody else does. We were the first to ordain a gay person. We ordained women long before anybody else did. And often got a lot of flack for that. But very often the rest of the religious community has kind of tiptoed along behind us, and we've been kind of pleased about that. The problem with my denomination is that we are so obsessed with, hooked into, committed to justice issues that we very often forget the piety side of it. And so you have what logical and what most of you know, we have burnout. We send people out there and they work and work and work, and pretty soon they're exhausted and they're not feeding themselves. And so we lose them. And we lose them to all sorts of places. We lose them to self-serving kinds of denominations where everything's sort of given to them and they don't have to do anything. We may lose them to nothing. We may lose them to a deeply liturgical community where all they think they have to do is go and sit and pray. It's a dilemma that exists in the church everywhere, and it lives itself out most dramatically for those of us that are on the edges either way. What I like about this book is that it does a beautiful dance between justice and piety. And in fact, on one page, did I write down which page? I might have somewhere. Yes, 111. He said, I should have been able to remember that for him's sake. He says that they are the same thing, that justice and piety are one and the same thing. I've never heard that before. I haven't done the word study. I'm not sure the words would bear it out, but I love the idea. You can't have one without the other. Love and marriage, right? You can't have one without the other. And so they are one and the same thing, and the Beatitudes tie up justice and piety in a way that is just incredibly beautiful. And that is what he is doing for us in that book, and it's the thing I value the most about this book, is that the marriage of justice and piety, you got to do both. To fulfill your calling from God. Something on my mind I was going to say, but it has disappeared, so it may come back. I want to say just a couple of more words about the book. I think most of you have either heard comments on the fact or observed yourself that it is not particularly well written. The writing is sometimes convoluted. There are some arguments where I have a huh written next to them. I have no idea what he's trying to say. There are other places, such as the passage that Alice read today, which I have highlighted and crossed and said wonderful next to. And so you get both. You get both. I don't know what's happened to editing in the writing world today. In the old days, a book like this never would have snuck through, but it would have been edited, and a lot of the clumsiness of the writing would have been edited out. However, I do have to say it is well worth staying with because of so much of what he says that is just so incredibly valuable and very, very helpful. I know what my thought was that I lost. I've always had trouble with the Beatitudes. And I think I was thinking about this, well, why have the Beatitudes given me so much trouble? And I think it's because I decided they kind of left me out. You know, I was nowhere near what the Beatitudes were promoting. And in some cases, I didn't know how to get near. And what I like about Crosby's book, although, as I say, he's relentless in some of what he says about how we have to change our life, it's doable. And it's not only doable, it makes sense. And it not only makes sense, but it's two-way. And this is what I really love. It's not, blessed are those that behave this way because they're going to get this. It's not what's saying at all. Although I'm not sure I knew that before I really was wearing this, but he's saying, as you grow into that, you move into this. And as you move into this, you'll grow even more into that. And it's a whole growth process that's being presented to us. And the two sides being held up. You can't do one without the other. So you choose where you start, and as you move here, then you have more going on that allows you to move back here, and it's a life process. And I really love that. And I'm so grateful for the selection of this book and the opportunity for me to read it myself, because it's given me a whole new way of being with the Beatitudes that feels rich and challenging and doable. Okay. Alice, when do I have to stop?
Well, at 11 or when it's comfortable.
At 11? Okay. All right. Well, I'm going to skip any further comments on the book in general then, because I want to get into the topic for today. Blessed are the pure of heart, for they shall see God. I like his chapter a lot. I like what he says about the looks. I think those are wonderful description, and I think every one of us could say, oh yeah, I look that way. I look that way most of the time. And I could even relate to how I felt when I was looking that way. And very often the way I felt was not very good, and it certainly wasn't very good with God. But a lot of this stuff is cultural. We're hooked into a cultural way of seeing. And you know, a lot of what he's calling us is to be countercultural, to find different ways of doing it. I spent a lot of time thinking about how I wanted to present this chapter. And I felt like I had a couple of choices. One was to go through and elaborate on the material as it was there. But I found that chapter particularly readable, and I wasn't sure it needed a lot of elaboration. I think he does a good job with what he's doing. So I decided I was going to kind of give you a different twist on this particular beatitude, and not one that contradicts his twist, because I don't believe it does, but that elaborates on some of the words that are used here, because they're very, very rich words, and they can be very helpful as we kind of check out our own experience with the words as they're written. So I want to start talking about the word heart. Read a novel. I've been reading a lot of novels in my period of exile, and one of my favorite genres is historical novels. And I particularly like historical medical novels. I'm just fascinated with how little they knew. And then I wonder, of course, what does that say about how little we know right now? But one of the novels I read, I have no idea what it was anymore, but I think it was written maybe in the 1700s, maybe 1800s. If any medical people here, they'll be able to tell me. But they only figured out that the purpose of the heart was to be to push the blood through the body within the last couple of hundred years. So we have to remember when we read about the pure in heart that they weren't thinking about what we think of when we think, you know, this little model of the heart with the thing shooting out. And I think it's in the Museum of Science and Industry in Chicago where you can walk through the heart. And, you know, we all think of the heart in that way. Gotta let that go. For the Hebrew people and also for the people of Jesus' time, heart meant something totally different. And the only reason it was called the heart was because its location was here. And so I want to talk a little bit about heart language. They used it a lot. It was used 850 times, the word heart, in the Old Testament. 850 times. That's kind of amazing when they didn't even know what it was for. It was used 150 times in the New Testament. And it had kind of a myriad constellations of meaning that I'd like to try to just highlight for you today. More than anything else, I think the heart was understood as the source of our feelings. Now take just a minute and stop, get out of your head, and think about where physically in your body you feel your feelings. Now, I think if I were to ask you to demonstrate that, most of you would put your hands somewhere right around here. And in modern medicine now, they have that connected with the solar plexus, where I do all this medical talking I have no business talking about because I know nothing about it. I've read it somewhere. But where there's a whole conjunction of nerves and where a lot of feeling happens. So for them, the heart was the center of our feelings. And so in various scripture passages, the heart was referred to as glad. My heart is glad. My heart is lifted up. I trembled in my heart. It was faint. It was like a burning fire. Visit much of this language from the Psalms where feelings just abound. And the heart, over and over and over again, the heart is where the feelings happen. The heart is also the center of our will or our desire. It's kind of our decision-making place. It's where we decide what we're going to do and where we will to do it. The scripture talks a lot about turning to God with the whole heart. There's that sense of desire, of we can also desire either good or evil in the heart. So in Genesis 8, when they're talking about, you know, remember the Genesis story that after the creation and the expulsion from the garden, mankind does this huge dive and everything goes wrong. We have this whole series of stories where terrible things happen. Cain kills Abel in the story of Babel and all of this. And then the author says, the tendency of man's heart was towards evil from its youth. So here it is that evil is originating or being chosen or influencing from the heart. Now, the heart also has understanding and thought, which is for us, I mean, thoughts come here, right? But not for the ancient Hebrew. For them, many of the thoughts, especially the profound thoughts, came from the heart. So in Ecclesiastes, the author said, I spoke with my heart. I think you and I know what that means. I think we've experienced that. But it isn't just our logical heads that speak. So the heart is the source of profound thought. The heart remembers. Again, it's not just the head that remembers, but the heart remembers. In Proverbs, the listener is instructed to write these words on the tablets of the heart. And again, you get a feel for that. That's a little different than memorizing them in our heads. Write them on the tablets of your heart. Heart memory changes who you are. It is very, very important. The heart is the place of God's action and our repentance. Create in me a clean heart, O God. How often do we pray that psalm? God can change hearts. In Ezekiel, God says to Ezekiel, I will take out their heart of stone and give them a heart of flesh. You know, we know what all this means, but we lose sight of it because we're such head people. And we have to be reminded that the heart is where so much of the real activity of our lives goes on. Jeremiah, in one of my most favorite passages of all, says, a new heart I will give them. And he does this wonderful thing about, and I'm not going to quote it right, but it no longer will they have to learn the law, but they will know God because of their new heart. So here's all this language of God acting in the heart and humankind changing because of what God does in the heart. Now, relationship was defined as a heart thing. I don't think that's so hard for us to understand. I think we tend to still see that, the relationship being a heart thing. But in Proverbs, when the author is addressing this young man, he says, my son, give me your heart. I like that. I think when we address, I got a 15-year-old kid living with me right now, my granddaughter. It's kind of an interesting experience. I haven't done that for a while. And figuring myself to be the source of great wisdom, I'm using these advantages to, to teach her the things she needs to know. And I've been astounded how much what we're talking about is heart to heart and not head to head. That just happened that way. And I think grandparents get to do that a lot, and it's really fun. But relationships happen heart to heart. And then finally, community is understood as oneness of heart. And I really like this, too. I like a lot of what Crosby says about community. He just writes some wonderful things about community. But this idea that... And somewhere in Acts it says, the company of those who believed were of one heart. And so there is a oneness of heart that defines community. And I really like that. I think oneness of heart defines you all. I think that's why I relate to you so well, because I just relate to that oneness of heart that you do. You don't agree up here at all. Doesn't matter. It's the oneness of heart that makes us a community. And it's in that oneness of heart that God acts. So that's what we're talking about when we say pure of heart. We're not talking... Alice was telling me the other day she'd heard a homily, I think what you said, equivalating celibacy with purity of heart. Am I correct with that? That's not what this book is talking about. Doesn't mean a celibate can't be pure of heart. But it does also doesn't mean that if you're celibate, you're going to be pure of heart. It does not follow. Purity of heart it means that there is transformation going on in all these places. I'm going to talk about purity in a minute, and then we'll maybe can take that a little further. In all these areas, in relationship, in community, what we remember and how we remember, how we think, how we act. This is the sum total of who we are spiritually is reflected in that word heart. So, how do we get to be pure of heart? And we have to look again at this word purity. Pure, I don't know, it makes me think of laundry detergent today. We've ruined so many words. And the word pure, I have this huge dictionary of the Bible that put out by the Interpreter's Bible. It's so big I can't find a place to put it on my bookshelf. And so the first thing I always do when I'm doing words is I go to that dictionary. Pure isn't in it. Can you believe that? Neither is purity. And I thought, this reflects how little we value that word purity. The depths of that word is lost. And we're a little afraid of it because we're afraid that purity means we have to be celibate. And it got associated with sexual activity. And I got thinking, if you had sex, you weren't pure. And it is such a departure from the real meaning of that word that I was horrified. I was really horrified. Now, what does purity mean in the Bible? What did Jesus mean by the word pure? There's reference in this book, and I believe you all did Marcus Borton's book also, Meeting Jesus Again for the First Time, where he talks a lot about the purity codes and so forth. When Israel was taken out of Egypt by God, and when they went through this Exodus experience, and then were taken out into the desert and were given this incredible experience of God in the mountain, which ever since I saw an erupting volcano in the middle of a thunderstorm being struck by lightning, I realized that what Israel experienced there was darn scary. Israel's big question was, how can we possibly relate to this God of such incredible power and holiness? We can't cut it. How can we do this? And at least one school of Hebrew theology, this is not all through it, there are other ways of looking at this, but at least one school said you have to become pure. The only way you can stand in God's presence is by becoming pure. And the way you become pure is you become holy. And you become holy by following the purity laws that the priests drew up. And they were extraordinary. And the littlest thing made you impure, and you had to start all over again. The story of the Good Samaritan, the most significant thing in that story is that the Good Samaritan, who apparently was a priest headed to do his duty in the temple, who had gone through weeks of purification so he could do it, touched this man. And when he touched that man, he was no longer pure. And so he had to start all over again. Now, this is what was meant by purity. It was meant by being completely clean, completely devoid of those things that somebody had decided made us impure. Kind of odd that this is the word that Jesus uses, isn't it? Because Jesus didn't take much to the purity laws, broke them all the time. And Jesus is, as Borg says, so well that every single time that Jesus was faced with choosing between compassion and purity or holiness or rightness, he always chose compassion. So why does he take this word, purity, and use it here? Well, he does it because when in taking it, he turns it on its head. He doesn't talk about those that are physically pure, which was what most of the purity stuff was about, refraining from eating certain foods and touching certain things and sleeping in certain places and a really very stringent kind of regulation. He says, blessed are the pure in heart. Now, the heart is a messy place. You can't make it pure in the sense that the Jew would have thought. Would not be possible. But when he talks about pure in heart, he is talking not about a place that we can control with a lot of rules. Okay, for 6 weeks I'm going to do blah, 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 blah. We've all tried that, haven't we? Pray every day at this time and not do this and forgive people I'm mad at and all these things we're going to do to purify ourselves, none of which work very well. Now, for Matthew and for what he's having Jesus say, pureness in heart is grace. It comes only from God. We are graced with pureness of heart. Now, that doesn't mean that we don't have a role in it. Because in all cases with grace, we also have a role in it. But it is not achieved by our willfulness, but by our willingness. If we seek purity of heart with all our hearts, then that can grow in us by grace. I really love that idea. When you think about what this heart is and what a complex, messy, easily corrupted, easily misled place it is, that purity of heart and purity meaning the ability to stand in the presence of God. So only if you're pure can you stand in the presence of God. That's granted us. Purity of heart is granted us so that we can stand in the presence of God. Now, Crosby has a wonderful sentence about this. He says, purification of heart is achieved by learning to care and not to care, as well as by taking time and making space to be still. It's the finest definition of purity of heart I've ever found anywhere. Letting go of those things you care about too much, caring for those things that you should have been caring about all these years, and then taking time to shut up and allowing God to be God in your depth. I just can't find anything closer to what I understand that to be. What I just said? What did I just say? All right. It involves letting go of things that distract us, caring about things that we should be caring about that we have ignored, and then taking time and making space to allow God to be God in the depths of our being. And I really like that, and we cannot achieve that by doing right things, but we can achieve it through grace, and it's a growing process not something that happens like that. It may happen to some people, but for most of us, it's a sometimes torturous growing process, but it happens. Now, one more thing. They shall see God. And then I hope this will all tie together. And I refer you back to his word looks, because his little section on the looks, because we do have to have pure looks. And the looks most of us bring to God, my look, and I was really glad to see him talk about it. I'm almost kind of ashamed of this, but my look is always greedy. I want more. And when I don't get more, I get mad. and I think all of us probably relate to certain ones of those looks that are the eyes that you look through in the hopes of seeing God. Now, in the Old Testament, seeing God was a rare event and could be dangerous. If we were not pure in heart, it could kill us. And they were very clear about that. I've always kind of liked that notion, because I think it's important to hold on to the idea of God's holiness. We in our culture today, you all may not be as bad about this as we are, but we in the Protestant church tend to make God a buddy and lose the sense of holiness. And to me, if we lose the sense of holiness, we've lost who God is. So this whole emphasis on holiness in the Old Testament, and you cannot look upon God or you shall surely die. And was it Elijah that got to, or was it Moses, one of them, that got to hide his head in the cleft and see the backside of God? A very profound story about the impact of looking upon God. Mostly in the Old Testament, when somebody saw God, it was because God had something for them to do. And so the famous story that you all know of the call of Isaiah 6, in the year that King Uzziah died, I saw the Lord high and lifted up. And he was terrified, rightfully so. He said, woe is me, for I am a man of unclean lips in the midst of a people of unclean lips, and I have seen the Lord, and I will surely die. That was common theology. This was a dangerous place where he was. And so the seraphim came and took a hot coal and put it on his lips and purified his lips. And then God says, so who shall I send? That's called a theophany, and there are a number of them in the Old Testament. They all have those same elements. Seeing God, terror, purification, and a call. So they don't say much in the Old Testament about just contemplating God. That's not very common. And they don't talk a whole lot about the experience, the direct one-on-one experience of God, except within the context of God's saving activity of the community. I'm going to take a minute. I shouldn't, because I'm going to run over a minute. But I don't know if I've ever told you the story about the time I was teaching Old Testament out at Goleta Presbyterian Church. And we were reading the story about Isaac waiting for his wife to arrive. And they'd sent off the servant, and the servant found them, and they were coming back. And so Isaac goes out into the field. And he is, in my version of the Bible, it says Isaac was out in the field meditating. Well, I love this. There's not much talk about meditating in the Old Testament. And so I took off with this, with a group, and I was saying, isn't this wonderful? He's out here preparing himself for this whole new place in his own life, and so on and so forth. And one of the participants was looking very confused. And I finally said, Lee, what is the matter? And she said, well, that's not what it says in my Bible. And I said, well, what does it say in your Bible? And it said, he turned aside to urinate. So I lost my contemplation. I went across the street to some Jewish friends of mine that read Hebrew, and we dug out the Bible and we looked up the word, and whoever thought meditation was really stretching. So when
isn't meditation a pause of regression?
Anyhow, my point is that when they talk about seeing God, they don't mean at all what you and I mean. I mean, we can talk. I think many of us have had experiences where we would say we've seen God. And that may be in forms of an image or unitive experience or something like that. The Hebrew Bible and the early time in Jesus' day, that's not what they meant. That was not their understanding. Now, when you get to the New Testament, the seeing God became associated very quickly with looking upon Jesus. And there are several passages in the Bible, one of the best known in Colossians, where it says, Jesus is the image of a living God. Now, the early people understood Jesus almost like a transparency. You could look at Jesus and see God. And I think many of us still feel that same way. And it's why we like to have icons around or crucifixes or whatever to remind us that in a very deep sense, when we look upon Jesus, we are looking upon God. We are seeing God. And so it's a growth in our understanding of what it means to see God. Now today, I think more and more we understand that, and I think it would be not unfair to read this into Matthew's reporting of Jesus' words. The word studies are always very iffy because, first of all, we don't have the original words, and secondly, they've gone through two translations already. And Jesus spoke in Aramaic, but it got written down in Greek, and so we have to be a little careful. All we can know is what Matthew was trying to say when he wrote down what he wrote down. But I think we can understand that the early church, and certainly Matthew, had such a deep sense of, first of all, Christ's presence with them. I mean, if anything shines out of the early writings, it was how close Jesus was to them. And in that closeness to Jesus, they saw God. They experienced God in very deeply profound ways. And we today have kind of built on that, and our culture and our own religious climate and any number of other factors have led us to move into contemplative practice, worship, Eucharist, hoping to see or to know God. When I went to Washington, D.C. to work with Shalem Institute, which is an institute for teaching a contemplative prayer, all of us there were very innocent and naive and kind of stupid and very excited because we were going to see God. And we'd gone there to experience God. There is so much today about experiencing God, and a lot of us become workshop junkies. We go and we get to experience God for a little while, and we're so excited, and then it dies, and we have to go get another fix. But we're all hooked into this notion of the experience of God. And I could do a whole session on that, but it won't. But I went off to Shalem wanting to experience God. And early on in the process, indeed, in a long contemplative period with a group, I had this powerful experience of God. And gosh, I thought I'd arrived. Yeah, wow, I learned this fast, and isn't this wonderful? And Tilden Edward, we met in small groups to discuss the meditation, and Tilden Edwards happened to join our group, and I was just busting with this. And he looked at me and he says, "But what are the fruits?" Fruit? Who thought about that? In good contemplative practice today, you balance the seeing God and the fruits. And the fruits become caring, not caring, and making space for God. And so the whole thing wraps up into this circle of meeting God, seeing God, transformation of the heart to be purer, allowing us to be ever more in the presence of God, which then takes us back into a deeper experience of God, which then increases. And this to me is an incredibly beautiful thing. But we never, ever can reduce it to anything, sexual purity or any other kind of purity. And we always have to remember that it's a circle that we go through. Justice to seeing God, to justice to seeing God, to transformation to seeing God. Beautiful, beautiful beatitude. I'm so lucky I got this one.